and also today, they seem so few. And at the same time, they praise House Bill 3410 for its merits, which I have yet to see. Their proponents boast that the bill will make the issuances of concealed weapons permits mandatory, yet Section 7, Subsection 7, clearly states that a sheriff may deny a license if, in the sheriff's judgment, the applicant would be a danger to himself or others or to the community at large as a result of the applicant's mental or psychological state, past pattern of behavior, or participation in incidents involving violence or threats of violence. It does not take an attorney to see that this section clearly shows that the issuance of concealed weapons permits is not mandatory, but discretionary by the sheriff, which is basically what we have today. But yes, we can appeal the decision if we can afford the costs involved in having the appeal heard in circuit court. The bill does not provide for the destruction of the record of sales forms which are submitted to the state, either for the purchase or sale of a firearm. So essentially, this bill does create a registration process of all firearms in the state and where they are at. Do you think that the criminal will let you know where his firearms are at? As to the stiffer laws, the bill proposes that unlawful possession of a firearm is a Class A misdemeanor under Section 13. That is its present classification as well. Yet under Section 23, a person is guilty, and I quote, of a Class B felony for not following the provisions of the transfers of this bill. I would think it more serious to be in unlawful possession of a firearm than not to fill out the correct forms. Last week, we heard testimony from the proponents that they had polled their membership and found that they endorsed the bill. I offer for your examination copies of a petition opposing House Bill 347. This petition was displayed last Saturday in the town of Prineville, a small town in eastern Oregon with a population of approximately 5,000 people. You'll find that this petition has over 500 signatures in opposition to the bill. I believe this to be a truer indicator as to the feelings of the people of Oregon. In conclusion, it is our belief that the state does not need nor want further laws prohibiting their constitutional right to keep and bear arms, and urge you to consider this matter carefully with your constituents and oppose this needless legislation. If I can answer any questions, I'd be more than happy to.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions?
I have a question. You used the term in the bill that a sheriff would have to use to gain criteria to reject a concealed weapons permit, and that wording is danger to himself or others. Are you aware that that's a term of art?
I'm sorry.
A term of art that's used in the criminal justice arena and the psychological arena. It comes from the McNaughton rule, and that there's a lot
I'm
of...
I'm sorry, Representative.
Can you not hear me?
No, it's quite softly.
We'll yell. We need a better microphone system.
If you get close to it, they can really hear you good.
Yeah, unfortunately, this cord's almost
I'm somewhat
long.
Hard of hearing. Bear with me.
The term danger to himself or others is a term of art.
Yes.
In the criminal justice arena and in the psychological arena. And there's a specific case law relevant to what that means.
Yes.
And I don't think that it's as arbitrary as your testimony would lead us to believe it is in terms of the sheriff's ability to make that decision. There's a lot that goes into making a determination being a danger to himself or others that I don't think gives that latitude. Are you aware of something that I'm not that you can expound on that gives rise to your fears?
Representative Minnis, I am an ex-police officer. I've worked within the criminal justice system. I've taken this bill to two separate legal counsel, one specializing in criminal law, and they had both concurred that this is discretionary based upon interpretation. If you can show a pattern of somebody, and I will use this as an example, of a person who makes it a habit of stopping off at the local Elks Lodge for a beer on the way home, that could be construed as a person who abuses alcohol. Now, this is what I am being told by professionals in the legal field. And as long as you have the verbiage, the sheriff may, in his judgment, you've set aside a discretionary statute. Now, It's my understanding that there are only two counties within the state that currently do not issue concealed weapons permits as policy. One of those counties now has a new administration, and maybe that policy may change.
It's not going to change. I'm from that county.
But it's my feeling and the feeling of others that as long as the clause that the sheriff may, in his judgment, we're basically having the same thing again. However, we do have an appeal process. However, I'm not a rich man, and I cannot afford the cost of hiring an attorney and paying court costs and trial time to appeal this.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, just a comment. Mr. Petrosky, I appreciate your comments, because one of the things that's going to be used, should this legislation get to this legislature in terms of its history, are things that you're saying now which will establish legislative intent. And it's my opinion that that's not the intent of legislation. So as far as if we're looking back at legislative record, I don't think that you're going to see we're establishing as a legislative record that it's a broad discretionary power on the part of the sheriffs, but there is going to be some standard that they're going to have to ascribe to in terms of making that determination. So, but I do thank you for bringing your concerns here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there a Dr. Elliot? Is he testified?
No, Wiener's left.
Elliot Wiener? Weiner.
Oh, no, they are here.
They are here.
They're in lieu of Mr. Dr. Wiener.
We have somebody in lieu of Wiener. I want to say I'm very sorry that we're running as late as we are, and I'm a freshman, so this is my first session chairing a committee. If I had it to do again, we probably would try to move this bill up first and get some of you out of here, but we're going to keep on going until all of you get your say. So if you wait around, you'll get a chance to talk.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Diana Godwin, representing the Oregon Psychological Association. I don't want Representative Dominguez to leave because Dr. Elliot Weiner, who was here all day Friday and then most of the day today but had to leave to treat a patient, left his testimony with me, but he had a particular gift that he wanted to present to Representative Minnis, because
oh, no.
I understand you and Dr. Elliot Weiner had a conversation in the hall last Friday about nut cases. He has brought for you a nut box filled with nuts. This is a nut case.
I'll bring you my example of a nut case sometime.
Okay. But that's for you.
It's not worth more than $100.
You know, it's not worth more than $100. There's nuts in there.
Oh, please continue and state your name for the
record. The purpose of our testimony today on behalf of the Oregon Psychological Association is to draw the committee's attention to Section 4 of this bill, which has caused some major concerns. Briefly, Section 4 requires in subsection 1 the superintendent or director of a hospital, private mental health care facility, or community mental health program to determine who of their patients should not purchase or possess firearms because of that patient's mental condition. In subsection 2, it provides that all persons licensed by the state of Oregon to engage in the practice of psychology, psychiatry, or medicine shall report immediately to the health division every client or patient diagnosed as being dangerous to self or others. This list to the health division then is made available to local law enforcement agencies. Our primary concerns with this bill are substantial, obviously. First, there is no such diagnosis as dangerous to self or others. That is not a clinical diagnosis. But more importantly, studies show, and in fact, I brought three more studies from Dr. Elliott. He did submit written testimony last Friday. There are cases case studies that demonstrate that the attempt to predict future violent behavior or dangerousness by psychologists is no greater than the ability of any average person to predict future dangerousness. The best predictor of dangerousness is past behavior. And we have a major concern about being asked to predict dangerousness and the considerable concerns about our liability if we fail to turn in a client, if we fail to make that judgment call on the side of turning in the name of our client to the health division. We're very, very concerned about the destructive potential of this section to the therapeutic relationship between a mental health provider and their patient. And also, I noted the previous speaker pointed out the difficulties and cost of appeals under Section 10 of this bill. Under Section 10 of this bill, if your name is on a list, and one of the other problems of this section, Section 4, is that it does not put any time limit for the length of time your name is on a list in the Health Division, does not provide whether or not you are ever notified that your name's been put on a list. And then when you are denied a permit under Section 10, you can appeal, but the difficulty of the appeal is substantial. You must demonstrate on page 13, you must demonstrate that your mental health history and current mental health status clearly and convincingly demonstrate that there's no significant chance that the petitioner may act in a manner dangerous to the public, to himself, or to others. And I know the lawyers on this committee will appreciate the difficulty of proving that kind of negative, particularly by clear and convincing. So we have major concerns with Section 4. And I will defer now to my colleagues who are at the table with me.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
John McCulley, representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. I'll just add a little bit to what Diana talked about as relative to Section 4, which is where our physicians have their biggest concern. They, too, know the same studies that she cited relative to trying to predict dangerousness. It's been shown that can't be done unless it's based on past behavior, and that's something I want to talk about in a minute. The other part of Section 4 that we think represents, I guess, a false premise in this bill is what has been held out to be the fact that the mentally ill are inherently more violent than anyone else. There are numerous studies in this area also that indicate that is not true. And to single out a certain class of people who happen to be mentally ill as being more violent than others is a false impression that's being left by this legislation. And if one thinks that restricting firearms to that particular class of people may solve all crimes of violence using a firearm, that just would not be true. And I think it's important that because there is a certain stigma attached in Section 4 of this bill, that it's important to understand that, from what I understand, the data does not support that contention that's contained in Section 4 of the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Clark.
Can I interrupt at this point and ask a question following there? Are you saying that, first of all, I agree with you, Section 4 is a mess. I mean, I saw that the first time I read it. Are you saying, though, that people who are mentally ill should not be treated differently for purposes of obtaining firearms?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, in a simple answer, I would say yes. I think that there is a subset of mentally ill people who can be identified as those who have exhibited past violent behavior, as evidenced when you get into, for example, Section 2 of the bill. You specify certain restrictions. I think you can identify a certain class of those who are mentally ill there who may have been committed based on a dangerousness standard, who may be under the jurisdiction of the PSRB, or people who have been in some way adjudicated to filling that.
Okay, but once we've identified that target population, you're not saying that you see a problem with treating those people differently than the rest of the world in terms of obtaining firearms?
Representative Clark, that's correct.
Okay.
As long as I alluded to Section 2, that's where I think the change could be made to handle this subpopulation that we're talking about. And it would occur on lines 3 and 7, or combining lines 3 and 7. And what we would suggest...
On page 8.
On page 8, excuse me, yes. Lines 3 and 7 on page 8 is to establish at that point... a person who has been committed, civilly committed because of dangerousness, would fall into this list.
That may require a change in the civil commitment statute to have the court find that that was the reason for the commitment. Currently, there's just a finding that the person is mentally ill without listing the reason for that finding. But that would be at least the suggestion, I think, would get at the population you're seeking to address with this bill.
Testimony. Any questions?
Are you going to testify? Because I do have some questions, but I'll wait till you're...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Diane Luther, Executive Director of the Mental Health Association of Oregon. We're a nonprofit citizens organization concerned with mental illness and fair treatment of persons who have had and may have mental illness. We also have concerns about Section 4, very close to what's been articulated. I want to point out that Sub 2 of Section 4 requires doctors of medicine to report immediately to the Health Division. That means your dermatologist could put you on a list, not notify you. You'd be on the list for years, and then you'd have to go to court and spend a lot of money and try to prove a negative to get yourself off the list. And once again, just reiterating that problem. We are in agreement that mentally ill people, most mentally ill people are not violent. Most violent people are not mentally ill, and we really want to separate those things. We want to say that if a person has, whether mentally ill or not, has a history of violence, and that can be demonstrated by the fact that they were committed for dangerousness or by the fact that they were found guilty except for insanity of a crime, then we would prefer that they not be allowed to have a gun for a period of time. And we're also looking at the issue of for how much time after this commitment has occurred. If you, for example, a person might be put in the hospital 15 years ago, 10 years ago have bought a hunting rifle, should they be a criminal if there's been no problem with that possession of a gun? So we also would like to suggest that a person, that there be language along the lines of what John was discussing in Section 2, but with a time limit of probably anywhere from 2 to 5 years would be acceptable to us. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Mr. Chair? A couple of things. If we can move away from Section 4 and back to Section 2, you may or may not be able to help me out on this. This may or may not be your bailiwick, but looking on page 8, line 4 and line 5, do any of the three of you have any thoughts on that language, what that means? I mean, am I a chronic abuser of alcohol? I had a glass of wine last night. I'll probably have one tomorrow night, and I'll probably even have a scotch and water this weekend. Let me get my answer. Let me get my answer first, because I know what you're going to say. You're going to say there's amendments, but I want to hear what they have to say first.
Okay. There's help for people like you.
Mr. Chair, I really
kidding,
can't.
Kidding, for the record, I'm just
comment.
Kidding. On that remark,
there is no help.
There is no help. Please proceed, Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chair, I can help you. Wouldn't you guys?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I don't. To me, the language is pretty wide open. I think it's subject to a lot of interpretation. Just as a layperson reading that, I'm sure there's a professional in the field who may be able to comment better, but that's really about all I could say about it.
All right. One other question, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Clark.
All of the language about, in Section 2, about prior convictions, talks about has been convicted or found guilty except for insanity of a felony. Talk to me about the except for insanity language and why that's in there, what your position is on that.
Pardon me. Representative Clark, a finding of guilty except for insanity is technically or legally not a conviction. So it's necessary that if you want to forbid people who have committed felonies from having guns, then you would want to include both those who have been convicted of felonies and those who have been found guilty except for insanity of felonies.
Okay, so for a dimwit like me, what we really ought to do is take out the comma after guilty. Been convicted or found guilty except for insanity.
The language, as I understand it, in statute reads guilty, comma, except for
right,
insanity.
Right, I understand that, but I mean in terms of my understanding what we're doing here, we're not We're not accepting out.
Except for insanity.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah, I understand your problem with that, yeah.
Relating to that, Representative Clark, we are suggesting that the words "found guilty except for insanity" also be inserted into line 42 right after that as it relates to misdemeanors involving violence within 4 years.
That's all the questions I have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, let me just continue on that point a moment. If you do that, then you have covered all the people who are under PSRB jurisdiction, and then you could eliminate item J, which is on the next page in that same section. And that is one of the suggestions that we've made.
To your testimony, I had kind of a question on the definition side. I know that we use as one of the findings by a court to determine that a person is unable to care for themselves and that we're going to incarcerate them because of their mental state, that the person would be potentially harmful to themselves or others, or I'm not sure if I'm catching the exact language, but it's the same language, I think, as the language in this bill. And that language is taken before, I believe. Is that correct or is that not correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, the standards are unable to care for personal needs or dangerous to self or others. It's not both together.
It's either or.
Yes.
Right? And this one just includes the danger. If you're not able to care for your personal needs, we don't care about that in this statute, but we do care about if you're a danger to self or others. And it's the same language.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And that language is used to incarcerate people because they're a danger to themselves or others, and they fall under one of the it's a two-pronged test, as I recall. You've got the one side that says you've got mental problems and the one side that says that you can't care for yourself or you might harm yourself or somebody else. Now, that you could be crazy but able to care for yourself and not have harmed anybody, and they'd have to leave you alone, in other words.
That's correct.
Well, if we're using that standard and we use that standard effectively in a process to incarcerate people, why can't we use that standard effectively in this process?
Mr. Chair, just speaking to Section 4, there is no judicial finding that standard has been met in Section 4. Mm-hmm. So the net broadens significantly. What we're suggesting is that you use that standard, use it in Section 2 of the bill, which establishes the list, and if a person is indeed found by the court to be dangerous to self or others, then they would fall within the parameters of the bill.
All right. Thank you very much. My time for my question is up, so I don't need the questions of the committee.
That's good.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Have we called, I believe it's a Dick Rice. Somebody, Richard Rice, Richard Bice.
Yeah, Dick Rice is okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I wanted to submit this for the record. How do you do that?
You already did.
I've already done it.
Oh, we already have it. So it's already in the record.
Okay. There's some points in here. I'm just a citizen, concerned citizen. And there's some points in this book on page 15. Could you turn to that?
Page 15.
It's understood that each representative would read the book through before Tuesday. Is that understood?
Yeah, we're going to commit this to memory, and we might even write a little cliff note item on this for future use.
Okay, in the middle of page 15, starting with the word, "The Constitution shall never be construed to prevent the people of the United States who are peaceable citizens from keeping their own arms." Alexander Hamilton's, that was his statement. These are men with credible reputations. Would we agree on that? The next statement is this, most interesting to me as a private citizen. Firearms stand next in importance to the Constitution itself. They are the American people's liberties, liberty teeth, and keystone under independence. Can you hear me, Calhoun?
Yes, I can.
From the hour the pilgrims landed to the present day, events, occurrences, and tendencies prove that to ensure peace, security, and happiness, listen to the next statement, please.
I'm just the committee staff, sir. Just keep
going. Okay. The next part, the rifle and pistol are equally indispensable. The very atmosphere of firearms everywhere restrains evil interference. They deserve a place of honor with all that's good. Now, the man that said this would have credibility in our, I'm sure, with each one of us. You agree? Gentlemen?
Well, there's...
Sir, typically, you're here to give testimony and we're here to listen.
Oh. And you're okay.
And we'd love to ask you some questions when you're finished.
All right. Okay.
It's difficult if we get into a question and answer back and forth.
We understand your point that this person would have credibility in our society today.
Here is on page 3, please. That's all we need now is page 3 in this book. And since you're going to have it committed to memory by Tuesday, I can double check. Communist.
We'll expect your examination on Tuesday.
Thank you.
Written form.
I appreciate that. Communist V.I. Lenin said, "A system of licensing and registration is a perfect device to deny gun ownership to the citizens." In 1968, listen to this quote. This is surprising, isn't it? The director of the National Task Force for the Control of Firearms was asked, why the Americans were suspicious of gun control. He replied, "Because they know we are coming to get their guns." Now, that's a quote. I'm just reading it. Don't know the fellow's name. Interesting quote, is it not? Let me see if we got one more. We do. Page 14, please. Bottom half. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, we're looking. Please proceed.
Proceed. Right. We can listen. We know what we're doing.
I don't want to waste my time. I drove a long ways to present this. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The framers of the Constitution knew from firsthand experience that the worst crimes in all history have been perpetrated by governments. You can read along with me. And thus, it was their intent with the Second Amendment to keep the private citizen armed. Notice the word private citizen. That was the intent. That this was the intent is clear from their writings. Take, for example, the writings of Hamilton in Federalist Papers. That's Alexander Hamilton. If the representative of the people betray their constituents, there is then no recourse left but in the exertion of that original right of self-defense, which is paramount to all positive forms of government, which, against the usurpations of the national leaders, may be exerted with infinitely better prospect of success. Over 100 years ago, Supreme Court Justice Story said, "If the people frame a constitution, then the rulers must obey it. Neither ruler nor functionaries have the right to cripple or destroy it because, according to their view, it is inconvenient or unwise." Now I have just a couple of questions about the bill itself.
Okay, we don't answer questions. A couple things come to my attention. The other committee members are going to have to leave soon, so I want to try to...
All right.
Have other people's testimony heard also.
Just,
I want to say I agree with you that the guns and the biggest portion for reason for them being in the Constitution as it is that the means of redressing government.
It would seem.
Anybody on this committee would quarrel with that, but please summarize as briefly as possible so we can get on to everybody else, too.
Section 21, Class B misdemeanor, ORS 166240. I'll read it. Concealed, the misspelling, slung shot, it says, in your bill, the new bill. I mean the revised bill. If a kid has a slingshot, I'm sure it means that, in the back pocket, now I'm making this statement, covered by a shirt, would this be a concealed weapon? This is under concealed weapon, Class B misdemeanor. Would this be a concealed weapon? That's in the bill. Then my concluding statement is this. We should, as citizens of Oregon, work together and help Vera Katz avoid being a law violator because, gentlemen, in my opinion, as a voter and a private citizen, this is a clear violation of the Second Amendment. Any hindering of firearm ownership to the citizen, the peaceful citizen. Now, how many people in your district do you consider peaceful?
Probably not more than a handful. But.
I thought you might consider the ones that elected you. All right, one more question.
those were the peaceful ones. Yeah, you ones that voted against me.
You don't know Representative Calhoun.
All right. Now, one more. Will the vote, when the voting time comes, will it be a voice vote or a recorded vote? And I want to make sure that it's a recorded vote
on this committee?
To vote.
Yeah, there's the tape recorders on right now.
Yeah. What I'm getting at is when it comes.
I don't know if I can answer your question directly, but I can tell you what I got from talking to the members of my gun club. The people who hold concealed weapons permits and are really interested in concealed weapons permits are generally, who are a smaller number, are generally willing to accept the compromise as it is. The rest of the club would never accept this bill with the fingerprinting provision in it, if that gives you any indication.
National Rifle Association wants the fingerprinting for non-handguns with the sunset on it, which is expected to wind up running into the federal law anyway, but they want the fingerprinting for the study that's going to show that people that buy guns are not Patrick Purdy.
I understand why they want the fingerprinting, but I have considerable expertise in computer systems, and I think the people who are asking for these things are naive, including the National Rifle Association.
Appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Clark.
I'm going to apologize to the remaining witnesses. I do have to leave. Just say I appreciate people coming from as far away as John Day. Representative Dominey has agreed to help us out by sitting for a while as an ex officio member, and he and I stay in close contact, and I do regret that I have to leave, but I do.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Representative Clark's going to go fight for truth, justice, and the American way, so we'll carry on without him. We have a some more people against the bill. We have Charlie Mills and Dean Smith and William Warder. Wartner?
Warther.
And he's for and against the bill. Mr. Mills, please.
Yeah, I'm Charlie Mills, a member of the Albany Rifle and Pistol Club, Oregon IPSC, which is a state organization of the World Organization, International Practical Shooters Confederation, USPSA, which is the United States chapter, the World IPSC body itself, and the NRA. I'm a competitive handgun shooter. I shoot probably between 20 and 30,000 rounds a year. I've shot guns ever since I was, 8, 9 years old. I've never shot anybody. I've never shot at anybody. Never committed any crimes with any guns. And I don't feel that it's right for me to have to go through fingerprinting, photographing, because a certain small percentage of the people in this country are determined to break laws and do things the wrong way. they're the ones that should be punished, not me. I feel that if you want to make a dent in crime, you got to make it more dangerous for the criminal than it is for the victim. Until you do that, you're never going to do anything with crime. Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
First of all, I have some written testimony I brought with me from a friend that was unable to attend. If you just want to put it in the record.
Of course, sir.
Thank you. Thirty years, I guess, it's taken me to get to this point. Raised four sons in those 30 years. None of them been involved with dope. All of them law-abiding citizens. All four of them have been rifle champions of one sort or another in their lifetime already, and they're not to exceed 22 years old. I can see in this, I'm not an attorney. I'm a 30 years of a businessman and having to deal with laws and attorneys and public and criminals and whatever. I can see in this bill my common sense and my ability to read and comprehend that there are a lot of items in this bill that are going to make, could have the possibility of injuring one of my family. Because we left too much up to the discretion of sheriffs, state policemen, city policemen, judges, attorneys, which all these people are in, are as I am, they're human beings. They can make mistakes. That's my first concern. My major concern is that I guess after 30 years, I am just fed up with all the laws and everything that are being that have been passed. The thousands of laws have been passed that do absolutely nothing towards curtailing crime, and have inhibited in me and my family, in many ways in our lives, and we've suffered along with them, went along with them, spent the money for them, backed them, obeyed them. Yet criminal activity today is worse than it ever has been. And the only thing so far that you folks haven't proposed is that, and it is in law, we can openly carry a weapon right now. Legally, all of us can openly carry a weapon. So why do we need to pass laws to carry concealed weapons? I mean, when we can all carry openly, if we all go to carrying openly, I'm afraid that they're going to start thinking about shooting each other.
Testimony. It sounds like you're complaining not only about the discretion that's in this law and the authority the government has, but also the discretion in the current law.
Yes, sir. And it's not only the gun law. There are several other laws dealing with criminal activity that have failed.
Thank you very much. I believe it's Mr. Werther.
Yes. One of my concerns was is the composition of the bill, its origin. And one of the members of the board was from the Catholic Council. And his input that he gave in testimony here the other day, in each instance he kept saying, the church's position is this, the church feels this, the church feels that. I feel as though that's a direct violation of the separation of church and state when a church comes in and makes that sort of presentation within the confines of the bill. Whatever input they've had, as far as I'm concerned, is unconstitutional. The other aspect of that is since 1982, the Catholic Church has been, or no, I won't say the Catholic Church, but the Vatican has been given diplomatic status. Some of the representatives of that church are, some of the priests are, in fact, envoys, and which gives me the impression that they are a foreign entity, which would bring me back to the Constitution again, saying, what right does a state have in making a treaty or a compromise involving an entity of that type when it's very clear that the Congress of the United States is the only body that is actually lawfully entitled to those types of agreements. The next thing I object to is just the fact that there are more restrictions on the private individual. The burden of proof becomes on us, and the burden on the criminal becomes less and less. Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Thank you very much. Move on here to Mr. Jim Farmer and Mr. Len Johnson. And Mr. Roger Maker. And Mr. John Benjamin.
For the record, my name is Len Johnson. A couple of us drove up from Klamath Falls to be with you today, so we've come a distance too.
You don't get much further away than that.
It's almost at the border, isn't it, huh? In opposition to this bill, I'll be as brief as I can and state that in the legislature that I've seen come out of this committee and out of this current body of legislature has been horrendously poor legislation for usurping the rights of the citizens of this state. I just got a copy of your 833 on the search and seizure. Telephone warrants, my goodness, that's awful. That's just the type of legislation that we don't need in this state to control the population. I've talked to people all over the state over the last 3 or 4 months, and time and time and time again, I'm hearing this over and over again. Our government is taking our rights away right and left, just one right after another, all in the name of fighting crime and fighting drugs, all in the name of making things better. And to give you due respect, your hearts, I'm sure, in the right direction, and your attitudes probably are to do good. But it isn't happening that way. This is not a good piece of legislation. We don't need any more rules and regulations for free citizens to be armed. The Constitution of the United States emphatically says that you shall not usurp the right to bear and to keep arms, both. That's basically all I have to say, other than written text that would take too long for the time that we have. So I've said my piece.
Gentleman in the middle, please.
Yes, my name is Roger Baker, president and owner of the Firearms Centers here in Portland, Oregon. I've been in the gun business, built my first gun when I was 13, and been in the business for 27 years now. I have never spoke up and just passed lately in the 2 months here, and I represent a lot of the gun dealers. We, the gun dealers, I'll make it brief as possible, are the ones who sell firearms, not you people. We are the ones who fill out the forms, the 4473 forms, not you people. We are the ones who determine whether you're a criminal, or whoever is a criminal. In the past 27 years being in the business and selling firearms, I have only had two. This is the hottest one I've got lately. I had to give my secretary a bouquet of flowers and let me bring this down here. I cannot give you the name. But it's a letter from the police department and how this stands. One thing, no felon of any kind will come into our office to buy a gun. There's so many laws here that they're going to scare them away. Number two, any man that is a felon will not come into my office and say, I'd like to buy a handgun, a rifle, whatever, if he knows he has to fill out these forms. That scares him away. He goes right across the street, buys them outright, off the streets. There's no records of them. He comes back into my place. Hey, Raj, check these out, see what they look like. hey, they okay, but I just turned you down. I got a letter here saying you can't from the police department. You signed this form here, 4473 form, and you got no on every one of them, and you turned around and went out and bought a gun. The police department says here, do not give this X person a firearm. He's prohibited from purchasing this weapon. We have then no control of anybody buying guns. These laws here that are coming out are going to create more crime in the 27 years that I've been in the business and went to 2 years of law school to study this to keep it up with you people. And now I finally come out in the open, and I got a lot more sessions to go to, television to go on. Another thing is the 15-day waiting period. They don't care about the 5-day waiting period. Anybody that comes into our place of business, it will be happy to sign any forms or any paperwork of any kind, simply because he knows he is not a criminal. He knows he is not a felon. He'll sign anything he wants. If he is a felon, he will not come into a dealership, and we're the ones who regulate the firearm sales, not the police, not anybody else. We are. He will not come into the store. He goes out across the street anywhere, comes back and buys them. Another thing is, here, that I'll make it as quick as possible, background checks. You come into my place of business, I'm Treasury. I'll give you all the background checks you want. I'll take these down to the police department, you, Brian, and I'll give them to the police department and say, this man here just bought a gun. They'll check you out, and they'll check your background out. In the meantime, if he is a felon, I will get the letter again from the police department saying, do not let this man have a gun. You, Mr. Bryan, will go out and get him off the street anyhow, and therefore we have more guns coming off the street than we do at the dealers. So if I was in charge of all the dealers throughout this nation, I would say, close them down. Now, I want all the dealerships closed. Who's going to sell these guns? Who's going to be legal of selling? The laws are not working. They're getting worse through my records in the past 27 years. We need more justice. We need more crime stoppage and not more laws. And our records in 27 years has proven this. Tape recordings left over from over and over. I'm getting more women that are in 80 years old, 75 years old, men in 50 years old, 75. Mr. Baker, you teach every person you sell a gun how to use? Yes, sir, we do. You would teach me how to use a gun? This is the reason why I want it. I flip on a tape and I get their reason right there. They will not say it here. They will not quote it here. They will not quote it in Salem or Notre Police Department. The NRA is one organization. The police department is another organization. The police department and the people throughout the whole United States knows police officers don't want anybody else carrying guns but themselves. That's a known thing. So they should be left out of the picture. NRA is their own organization. They try to keep the American people having firearms. They should be left out of it. It's the people like it's in here right now. They do not have their talk of what is actually happening. All they can do is come here, lay their piece on the line, but yet the facts are not brought out because a lot of people don't want to talk to dealers. But we, the dealers, know what's going on. We have to give these people their guns. We have to take them away from them. And they won't get this information in the books or anywhere else. That's all I have to say about it.
I wanted to ask a question. First time since I sat up here that I've heard any testimony on that from a gun dealer. And one of my concerns with it is the fingerprinting portion, which in the bill it says that if the fingerprint is not legible, that you have to redo it. How many gun dealers do you know of that have taken the courses that it would require to take a to be able to provide legible fingerprints?
What is fingerprinting going to do, Representative? I'll tell you what it will do. This man right here has child support to pay. He's got a stolen apple 10 years ago, or whatever. He's got a record somewhere down the line, and this has been brought up to me by very prominent people in legislation in Congress. If a person comes in here and he says, Jesus Christ, man alive, I stole an apple. I've got three tickets I got to pay here, and I'm not a felon. He will not come in and buy a gun because in due time, the way our system is going, those fingerprints by the police department will be used for everything else except a firearm check. I'll guarantee you that. They'll use them to get anything that they've got in the background. And that will come in there before you know it. The man forgets about buying a firearm. His problem is, what is he being picked up for because he gave him a fingerprint in the first place? No, the fingerprint system will stop people from buying firearms legally. They will go out in the field and buy them just like coke, methamphetamines, whatever that junk they call. That's still going on strong. we here in Congress and so forth and so on are pushing the laws to create the people from stop going into the dealerships. We just already close them all down, get it over with, and let them have free flow.
My question was, do you feel that you are qualified to give fingerprints, and how many guns?
I'm qualified during, so I got college degrees up to here, so I can make fingerprints. That is not, it's what's behind that fingerprint.
I understand that.
And I can give the fingerprints, yes.
I was just wondering how many gun dealers would have the capability of giving fingerprints.
I think all of them can give them. I can show them how to give them. That's no problem. It's what's behind it. They'll say, hey, you could buy a gun, you're going to have to take fingerprints. Hey, I don't want that. I'll see you later. Goodbye. We got another gun that's not registered nowhere. We cannot keep control of these firearms anymore. And it's because of the laws and no deterrent. We have no deterrent on the criminals.
I think it reminds your point that we're basically spinning our wheels in this anyway, because if the
criminals... They can put me in jail, but I'm saying that from my 27 years, my daughter's 13 years old, she's a professional shooter, she goes around the world now. I will not present her with the crime status that's going on in the legislation or anything else. I do not want her to know anything about this stuff. I forbid her to read anything about the laws that this Congress brings out or this Senate brings out. I want her to know that a gun is something to use as a tournament shooting, which is best. She's a fast draw artist, 13 years old, and she goes out and she does not look at that gun as a criminal aspect. She uses it as a bow and arrow or playing golf or anything else. And as soon as anybody comes up, it's illegal of that, somebody's in trouble with me, because they are putting that thought in her mind as we are putting this thought into the legal people. Purdy had 5 months to wait. He did it. He had more crime against him with the legislation, did not do anything about. The laws didn't do anything about. They let it go. They got him off for misdemeanors. So when Purdy did what he did, he shot himself, and nobody's even mentioned the gun he shot himself with. He shot himself with a Thoris 92B. What he did, he knocked out some hotshot attorney from getting him off for the misdemeanor again. And he knocked all the citizens out from paying monies to keep him in a house that he never had before in his life.
I just would say, if you know the name of that attorney that would have got him off on a misdemeanor, let me know his name, because I might need to use him someday. Or maybe also.
You're right. See, you hit it right on.
But anyway, I think Mr. Benjamin might have a few comments to add to your comments. Do you have anything, Mr. Benjamin?
My name's John Benjamin. I'm, of course, an NRA Life member. All gun guys are, sort of. I'm also a Class II firearms manufacturer in the state, one of maybe three or four here. I manufacture NFA firearms. I'd like to speak as a manufacturer that I've read this bill, and I believe this bill can only be described as a Frankenstein. The bill will be implemented in ways you people can't even imagine. What is wrong with this bill, and I say that of things that have actually happened to me, enforcement actions that people have tried to generate against me for insignificant things. First of all, as a gun manufacturer, and I also have a dealer's license, I strenuously object to this paperwork requirement. If a form isn't received by the state police, it's a felony. I went through a period of 2 years here where federal documents, what were required that I have to report from arms I manufactured, were sent to the ATF. And we played games for 2 years, and it eventually got down to that they accused me of not sending them. I produced the documents, the registered return receipts, which only a person has as evidence of mailing a document. I was accused of mailing the federal government empty envelopes. Fortunately, this happened 2 years ago when there was a law change, a federal law change banning the further manufacture of NFA firearms. And I fortunately foresaw trouble. And I mailed copies of these all to the congressional delegations from the state of Oregon and asked them to mail copies to the feds, and they mailed them copies. Well, for 2 years this process went on, and I was inspected numerous times trying to find something that I reported I'd manufactured that I didn't physically have, and that didn't, wasn't, they didn't find that, and eventually I just got to transfer a lot of this stuff. I had John Nichols' gun in my shop for over 2 years, and I couldn't transfer it back to them because they pull in with the documents. Some documents were returned 7 and 8 times, and I ran out of places on them. They were similar to this man's 4473. I ran out of places on them to have them put receiving stamps on these documents. And eventually they were approved unaltered, because once you submit one of these things, you can't change them. And they were eventually approved and they were transferred back. The fingerprint provision of this bill, from my own personal experience, what will most likely happen, you will find some individuals who do not want to issue these concealed weapons permits or transfer guys' handguns. And it's very simple to just send the forms back and say the fingerprints are unclear. I was kind of alarmed when I talked to an individual last week here that was from one of the police departments that had a hand in writing this bill. And even in his testimony, he mentioned, well, the fingerprints may not be clear enough and we may have to send them back. And then I spoke to him in the meeting room, and his position was he wasn't going to sign no concealed weapons permits and he was not going to sign any NFA papers. So right now you've got a guy that had a hand in writing this bill, didn't want any part of going along with what the bill says. You're going to end up in court if you have to deal with this guy. That's all there is to that.
Do we, I want to quick, do we have written comments as to specific
No, I haven't written. If I could take 30 seconds of one of my
Please summarize what
your time, Steve.
What I would like is when it comes time we go to work session, I don't know if you're going to be able to be here or not, but whether or not you are, make an announcement right now. We're potentially going to work session on this bill, which means that's when we actually start voting and changing the bill around, and we voted out of committee next Tuesday evening.
I don't know if I'll be in the country. If you, I have an out-of-trip country schedule, army trip schedule.
If anybody that wants to propose amendments is going to get their shot, and if it seems like a couple people on the committee want to vote on them, we're going to vote on them. Doesn't matter what they are.
But
I might say that. Well, the meeting, what time's the meeting on Tuesday? 7?
No, 1:30.
1:30 on Tuesday?
Tuesday afternoon.
Okay, Tuesday afternoon at 1:30. If you have any...
They have to be to me by Monday.
They have, if you have any specific amendments, we've got to have them by noon on Monday. If you don't get them to us by noon on Monday, we're not going to consider them on Tuesday, and you may never get a shot. But if you have a specific amendment, you want to delete Section 22, or you want to change the language to say this, I'll be happy to entertain your amendment, but we have to have specific notions of what changes you want to make. And we're going to let everybody have their shot at changes. And I know you have some you want to make, and I think I'll probably agree with you on them. But I'd like something specific, and I'd like you to come in and work with us on that particular section of the bill. We have, I mean, this bill is so big, we don't have really one bill here. We've got about 100 different ideas. Yeah, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a motion to table be out of order is an amendment, Mr. Chairman?
Well, anyway, I just wanted to make sure everybody knows coming by noon. And, yeah, you can, the proposal to get rid of the bill altogether, we're going to have that one too, obviously, but I don't know what's going to happen with that. Anyway, go ahead and please.
Can I make some technical comments to your bill here?
Please try to summarize this.
Okay, I'll summarize it. I had one person from Portland yield some time to me, so he probably won't come up. Section 1, as I said, line 42, I have a stringent opposition about a lost document. If a form gets lost, I got a felony beef on my hands. Section 2, firearm silencers. Right now, the way the federal statute goes, if you've got fender washers or any parts like that, or boot eyelets, I know an individual got charged for a silencer beef that had boot eyelets in his shop because one of the manufacturers used that as a muffling device in his silencers for a first gas chamber. He got a federal indictment placed against him for having a one-quart jar of boot eyelets. No status offenses. That's crazy. Second item, possession of a machine gun. I have a real beef with that. A machine gun isn't what you think it is. If I could approach the chair for 30 seconds, I have a little graphic demonstration here.
Yeah, go ahead and come on up. Let's see what you got.
30 seconds. Hold your left and right hand out.
Wait a minute now.
No, this is not, I'm not being serious. This is a legal part you can possess. There's no problem. Sell that freely without paperwork. This is a federally registered machine gun with an NFA transfer paperwork. They were both manufactured on the same machine on the same day.
People have
been put in federal penitentiary for possessing one of those devices and no other gun. That's
right.
It. It's not a joke. It's serious business. It's a status offense. We don't need that.
So one is illegal and the other one isn't.
Well, yeah, that's correct. No, one is legal. They're both legal. They're registered. One's registered and one isn't by the data manufacturer. Okay?
One with a hole in it's legal? The one with this slot?
That, no, it doesn't matter. Both the devices are the same. One just isn't finished. Now, but as far as the federal government goes, those are both the same device. Okay? That's what you're dealing with a status offense. Okay? This seems all a bit bizarre until it happens to you, and it isn't bizarre or funny anymore. You're staring at a big felony beef, a federal beef, and they do that. The next item, firearm silencers. If you shoot through tires, and a lot of ranges do it, to cut down the rolling thunder, you got a firearm silencer on the bill, and you got a felony beef. Next item, obliterates the serial number. I'm a manufacturer. I put serial numbers on things. I break tools. I have to kind of cut the numbers off if I break a tool manufacturing something with a pantograph. I commit a felony if I wipe the number off and put it on again, according to this bill. Possession of firearms with no serial numbers. I just bid on a bunch of guns that the Portland police tried to sell, SWAT team guns. Some of them didn't have numbers on them. They were crime guns that were taken off of crimes. They tried to sell them to me on a sealed police bid. I guy the gun, walk out the door. I get busted for a felony beef because I got a gun with no serial number. Possession of the gun is prima facie evidence you obliterated a serial number. It goes on and on. The bill will be enforced by judicial people and law enforcement in ways you people don't even believe possible. It will happen. It has happened to me.
I appreciate your comments and concerns. And like I say, the best thing we can do is get each one of them on a separate piece of paper and what section and what changes you want, what the language is that you want
to
see.
I'll try to get that in before my trip. I've got a trip out of the country.
Maybe your partner can come in and help us with the with
okay,
the
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Who hasn't set up yet here? There's one guy that was pro.
Here.
That's the guy.
We got these three. I don't know if Texas is still here.
Yeah, Mr. Steve Bach.
Do I get some time? I yielded my time.
Oh, okay.
Is it okay if I come up
here? If you'd like to come up and add a couple of comments, that'd be fine. I'm going to get everybody gets their shot here.
Thank you.
I previously had a little testimony last Friday.
Oh, please, yeah, please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Steve Bach.
Person sits over here.
Live in Washington County. And I wish to offer just one or two minor things additionally. It was mentioned before by Ted Dowd that Kessler Delgado deals with Section 21 in this particular bill. And we've had a number of references to it saying that it's current law, but by Kessler Delgado, even though it may be in the books, it is unconstitutional in the state of Oregon. So that entire section should be struck. And my entire, one of the things I mentioned earlier was that if you wish to put anything back in like that, it was important to do it with putting a change in languages. It was Kessler Delgado.
Okay.